Welcome back. We have a little Beach Boys for their anniversary here today on the air. And Peggy Sue was made on this day. Became a very famous song. If you're a Beach Boys fan, there it is. We are here now with Commissioner Anthony Batts, of course, the police commissioner from Baltimore City. He joins us here in studio, and we appreciate his making these regular visits. Good to have you with us, Commissioner.
Thank you so very much. On a day that you're talking about Peggy Sue, Chaka Zulu, David Bowie, Iman, George Foreman, you're all over the place. Thank you for having me.
Good to have you here. We love our day in history.
Yes, sir.
410-319-8888 is the number here to join this conversation. 410-319-8888. You can write to us at steinershow@gmail.com. Log on to our Facebook pages, which I'll be checking. Tweet us at Mark Steiner. Good to have you here in this. Always with us. Please join us for this conversation with Commissioner Batts. Commissioner, I guess the first question on everybody's mind, as you have a lot of stats there arrayed in front of you.
Just in case you ask me something. Hey, yes, sir.
Now, let's have a cup of coffee and go home.
Amen.
In all seriousness, we've had 19 people killed in Baltimore this year. I mean, 18, and one by a police-involved shooting. So the year's off to a really bad start. We ended up very badly last year when they looked at murder rates and compared Baltimore to other cities. We were kind of off the charts. I mean, New York would have had a couple of thousand murders if they had had the same per capita rate that we have in Baltimore and most of the cities in America. D.C.'s gone down. Chicago went down. Philly went down. Your old town of Oakland went down.
See, D.C. went up, but go ahead.
But that was – but they contributed that to the 13 killings at the Naval Shipyard, which is kind of an aberration. But so
actually, they took that out, but keep going.
Oh, did they take that out? Okay. I stand corrected. So talk to me about what your response to that is. I mean –
Well, the response is bottom line is that we got to do better on those circumstances, whether it drives at homicides, and start looking a little bit more in depth at the causes of homicides and how the organization has addressed it. One of the things that we struggle with, two major things we struggled with last year, or actually three when I think about it, is number one, we had very dramatic attrition rates. Our attrition was probably up 45% above the norm. The organization has been struggling with attrition for the last 5 years, and last year was a spiking year for us. So we didn't have the number of resources that we needed to get the job done, which is none of this is excuses because we had to do a better job. But at the same time, we also went through the mechanism that was there to address some of the violent crime, which is our violent crime impact team. We had some challenges there where I had to arrest several officers. We had to remove the leadership of that team and restructure it. So that was one of our main issues. Within that group violent crime impact team also, there was a high number of citizen complaints. So we had to reconstruct that and kind of rebuild it. So we went through a year of rebuilding. I feel more comfortable this year. Although we've had 18, we're eight homicides above where we were last year. There's a reason that I think you're going to be finding out in the very near future. This wasn't random attacks, we know what was the cause of this. And unfortunately, it's going to be a crime spree that took place involving a small number of people and that we're going to address long term. So I think we are going in the right direction. Our citizen complaints are down somewhere close to 40-45%. And that's citizens complaining about excessive force, how we treat them, how we deliver the service that we give as an organization. As you look at crime, other than the homicide rate, we're down in most other categories. As you go into this year, we're down in every category dramatically. Some of the numbers last year, and what I'm talking about is things like shootings are down dramatically 25%, rapes are down 42%, robberies are down 49%, burglaries are down 23%. So these are pretty dramatic numbers. Total violent crime in our city is down 42%. Total property crime is down right now 31%. And total part one, which is the cumulative of both those categories, is down 34%. So we have struggled at that homicide rate. But at the end of last year, overall crime in the city is down. As we struggle with that homicide rate when we go into January, overall crime in the city is down and continues to be down. And let me put that in a little context, and I'm going to send it back to you.
Right.
When we talk about violent crime, and I tell you that's down, yeah, I look at trends. I just don't look at day-to-day counting number by number. I look at trends and see where the city's going. Violent crime in 1985, the total number of violent crimes was 15,498 victims. In 1990, it was 17,942 victims. 10 years later, it was 16,003 victims. And of this year, last year was 8,638 victims. And you see the dramatic drop from 1985 of 15,000, 17,000 in 1990, 16,000 in 2000, 8,000 last year.
What kind of crimes are we talking about?
Those are violent crimes. And then violent crimes are homicides, shootings, forcible rapes, and robberies. So the city is becoming safer. You don't hear that. You don't feel that. I don't think you get that from the media overall. Do you have a sense of fear that's going on in this city? Crime continues to drop, and it is dropping now.
So you alluded to, and I'm going to hear a clip here, a couple of clips that we've had from our last show. We did a program a week ago with Doug Ward, who is head of the police leadership group at the Johns Hopkins University, and other community activists, young activists in this town, talking about their perceptions of all this. And we have some interesting thoughts from folks. We're going to play them on the air here in a moment. Let me play this one right now by Doug Ward, who is the man who runs the Hopkins Leadership Police Leadership Program and was a 35-year veteran of the state police, retired as a major. Really good guy. Been on the show a great deal over the years. But let's hear his clip, and then because it goes to what you were alluding to a moment ago, and I want to play this and we'll talk. Go ahead.
I was preparing for class, and I did a literature search of what's been done on gangs. It's one of the topics we're going to talk about on Friday, is poverty and gangs. It occurred to me that in many of the conversations we have, something comes to a tipping point. There's murders, there's some robbery string, there's all kinds of things going on, and then, oh my goodness, we have gangs. What are we going to do about it? And the police step forward, they say, we're going to try program X, and it's going to solve this, and we're going to get to the root of it. And although the police are a really, really key component, the unfortunate thing the literature shows clearly is that the problem with gangs starts in poverty. The problem with gangs starts when they're in middle school. You know, it's a social status issue. It's a hopelessness issue. And it starts with our youth. And even now, I hear it's elementary school is the place to start. Mm-hmm. So by the time the police get involved after the murder, after the robbery, after the incident, that's helpful, but it's not preventing the stream of youth coming into the system.
So that was Doug Ward, and I would, because I know I played that first. There's something else I wanted to play as well, but for a couple of reasons. One thing is you didn't say it outright, but it's not like you were alluding to the fact that you think these rash of homicides. No, I take that back. Not think is not the correct word. Your analysis is probably telling you that you're saying the rash of homicides has to do with gang related activity in a small group of people. But so, and you heard what Doug just had to say about that. So I'm curious your response to both things.
I think Doug is absolutely right. I don't disagree with him at all. I think as I came into Baltimore and tried to drive that discussion that direction, when you look at the police department in this region, puts a tremendous amount of weight on the police department, and the police department has a couple different things that it could do. And I'm oversimplifying this. Our power lies in enforcing laws. And so we have the ability to arrest people. We have the ability to cite people. The second thing that we have is being able to bring to bear other pieces of the city, asking the city government to get involved in communities. And actually the third thing, if I can say the third thing, is the bully pulpit, which is what I'm doing right now. It's having a conversation. And when I started having a conversation, we can deal with and we should deal with the most violent people in our community. There are just certain people that need to go to jail, period, bottom line. They're antisocial. They harm other people. They take human life. They need to go to jail. And I'm not pulling away from that at all, and I'm very, very, very serious about that. However, you have to do something about the supply chain, the supply stream. After I take off these very violent people, what causes these kids to get to this end point? And so we need to start at the beginning of this supply chain. And much it was stated, we need to do things to stop or address the hopelessness. We need to stop and address, as best we can, the poverty that exists. Now, the city of Baltimore has a large issue with poverty, and the question becomes, how do we deal with that and give hope to these young men and women, and more so young men, but also young women that we're having involved in violence now, to address some of the circumstances long range.
So are you saying you think it's gang related? I mean, this part of the issue is some people arguing that we're going after the wrong stuff, that it's not the organized gang is not as deep in Baltimore as people as you're alluding to other people. Some obviously you think it is. So what about your perception of that?
I think that's a silly statement.
Which silly?
Well, I think when people come and say it's not as deep-rooted as anyone believes, when I walked in the door, the city said it didn't have any gangs whatsoever, period. We don't have gangs that are here. We do have gangs that are here. We have I can rattle them off for you, a litany of them. And when we say gangs, we're not just saying your organized black guerrilla family. We're also saying drug crews. We're also saying neighborhood groups that get together for the purpose of conspiring to do criminality. You have groups out there from streets like NFL or DJ Boys, crews that have grown up together. They come together and they go out and rob people or do other harm or do shootings. So we do have an issue that's there. What I see on the streets now is, and what we're dealing with this year, is street robberies that are taking place. You have independent drug dealers that pop up in a neighborhood and want to do drug sales. Well, the more organized drug dealers who come with crews, groups, or gangs retaliate against them and cause shootings. We have a significant issue dealing with gangs within the city. And until we are honest about it, and until we sit down and really start collecting data and finding out where these kids are coming from and put in preventative measures, we're still going to be chasing our tails for a long time.
So I'm curious, we also had on this program the law enforcement against prohibition. We're on this program just the other day. Who are retired and also some active duty police who are working on this issue. Are you allowed to have, can you have a public opinion on that issue, whether or not that part of the problem is we need to address, some people argue you need to address the issue of legalization of drugs before you're going to end this violence, because until you take the crime out of it, the gangs are going to be pursuing it.
I think that's a deeper question, and I have a personal opinion that I will share as from my standpoint, from my life. But as far as should we legalize it or not, becomes a policy decision for politicians and the community to address. And the mayor has said this in a meeting I had with her, and I think she's very right. You know, where I grew up, not here on the East Coast but the West Coast, I grew up in a very impoverished environment, South Central Los Angeles. And I was bused out of South Central Los Angeles for about an hour and a half on a bus ride up to Los Feliz area, and went to a high school with very affluent kids. So I was living in two worlds. World number one was very rich, and most of the kids that I went to school with, their dads were doctors, attorneys, surgeons, producers, directors, et cetera, et cetera. Now, those kids experimented with drugs at different times, but it was something or a mechanism that clicked in to them when they went to college, or as they were into college, they stopped using drugs, and they moved away from the experimental phase of doing drugs and went into the corporate world. And today they're attorneys and doctors and lawyers, much like their parents were. And drugs didn't debilitate them for the most part or throw them off. Well, in the other world that I lived in, where my home actually was in South Central, when kids started experimenting with drugs and starter drugs, many of them did not recover. They didn't go into the corporate world. They didn't exceed and grow out of that. It debilitated a lot of them. A lot of them became addicted, and a lot of them are still dealing with the demons of early addiction or early drugs. So I have different a personal opinion that I've seen different parts of society deal with drugs and addiction of drugs.
So let me, when we were on the show last, and folks, I'm sorry, the lines are open, 410-319-8888. We want you to join us here. Your thoughts for the commissioner, your questions for the commissioner, 410-319-8888 on the program we had. Without the commissioner, you jam the phone lines with your thoughts on crime and policing. Want to hear what your thoughts are today? Write to us here at steinershow@gmail.com. You can log on to our Facebook page. I've seen people running a few things there. I'll see what's there. Tweet us at Mark Steiner, 410-319-8888. The last time you show, the state's attorney had not made a decision on the Tyrone West case and officers involved. He did make a decision. And you then, at least from what I've read in the paper, and I haven't read much about it since, instituted a public group or in partnership with the police to do your own internal investigation. Is that right?
Well, two things. Anthony Anderson case was.
I mean Tyrone West.
You said Tyrone West. But the Anthony Anderson case, which took place as I landed, my airplane landed on a Sunday in the Anthony Anderson case, which resulted in a loss of life, took place the Friday prior to the Sunday that I arrived. One of the things that I took a look at that is that there was a hue and cry from the community that we may not be fair, or we were going to circle the wagons, or we were not going to be transparent. On that, when I made a decision, and I've done this at different parts of doing my career, it's been the commissioner chief and two other agencies, is I thought to build that public trust, to be open, to be transparent. I didn't put together a citizen panel. I put together a panel of experts, doctors, public administration professors, police officers, people that have different expertise that see it a lot of different ways. And they made a ruling on Anthony Anderson that it was an unfortunate circumstance that took place, but there was no wrongdoing that took place out of that. And when we went before the TVs, what I told them their only mandate was to do is to be honest and be open, to be truthful. And if the police department did anything wrong, then say what we did wrong. If the police officers did what they were supposed to, then you say that and give recommendations, and we did that. With Tyrone West, the same thing. There's such a hue and cry that we're going to be transparent, we're going to be open, we're going to bring in experts. We have national experts that are on this panel. We've brought in people who've done this multiple times for the federal government, for the Department of Justice. And so we're bringing them in, and we're going to sit them down and do the same thing. And my mandate to them is going to be the same, which is the bottom line. It's just be open and honest and be truthful. And the goal for that is to have a transparent organization, to let people know that there is justice within the police organization.
I mean, so this is not an internal investigation to make your own decisions about the police officers involved? This is beyond what the state attorney did? Could this come out finding that officers either acted correctly, or if they didn't act correctly, they could be disciplined within the police department? Is this part of this as well?
Yeah, you have two different standards. What the state's attorney does is he deals with, is there any violation of law? With this contact between a citizen and a police officers, whether there a violation of law that someone can be held accountable for that? So that's what he rules on. What I have to focus on also on top of that is also looking at, was there any administrative policies or constraints that were violated in this confrontation or interaction with police officers and the resident?
So one of the things I asked you last, and we'll go to the phone, say, Shadia, I think I pronounced your name right, in Cecil County and Ivan in Baltimore, we're going to come to your calls and play these other clips for the commissioner. But on our way to break here, the last time, well, we have to go to break now, don't we? Should we go to break, then I'll come back with my question. Stay with us. We're with Commissioner Anthony Batts.
I made some breakfast and coffee. Look out my window. What do I see? A crack in the sky and a hand reaching down to me. All the nightmares came today. And it looks as though they're here to stay.
When the night has come and the land is dark and the moon.
That's it. Sam Cooke, Stand By Me. Born on this day, one of the great singers of all time, I think, and one of my favorite songs. We can just play Sam Cooke and be done with it. No, we can't. Anthony Batts is in the studio, the Commissioner of Police for the City of Baltimore. 410-319-8888 is the number here. Shadia, we're going to come right to your call, but what I was about to ask you was, the time before last when you were here, well, the last time I interviewed you was in your office and your conference room in the police department. You were here before that. And the question came up about the officers involved in the Tyrone West death and those involved in Anthony Anderson's incest. And this has been huge controversy. You, the last time we were together, saying you couldn't say for sure that no officers involved in one incident were involved in the other. What can you say now?
What I was told is that we don't have an overlap.
There is no overlap.
No.
So does that mean that the officers who were involved with Tyrone West's murder or killing were not involved in Anthony Anderson's death?
The officers who were involved in the arrest of Anthony Anderson, the two officers there, those two officers were not on the scene, as I'm told, at the Tyrone West case.
So we'll go back to the phones here. People are ready for you, and so are we. 410-319-8888. We'll take a call, then we're going to switch between the pre-records we have, the statements from our last show, and Shadia in Cecil County. You're on the air.
Good morning, Mr. Steiner. Good morning, Commissioner. How are you?
Good morning, ma'am. Good, thank you.
I just want to make a comment. I think that it's very good that you come from both sides of the fence.
Yes, ma'am.
You have the experience of, as you said, the inner city, as you were raised and brought up, and then you went to a school that, you know, high-end school, more or less. So you have a vast of experience that you could bring to the table that you can move Baltimore City forward to help address all the issues at hand. So I think that experience says a lot for a commissioner. And that was my comment.
Thank you, ma'am. The question becomes, does Baltimore want to move forward? And where does it want to go? Part of the reason we did the strategic plan is to ask the people who pay our salaries, the taxpayers, what do they want out of this police department? And what you show in the strategic plan and what we see is that we need to shift and change to align ourselves better with our community.
So let me go back to the phone to you, and I'll come back with this quote and another question for myself. 410-319-8888. George, you're on the air.
Good morning, Mark. How are you this morning?
Good morning, George Peoples. How are you?
I am so well. I'm doing well. How are you, Commissioner Back?
Uncle George, good to hear from you, sir.
Well, it's always good to hear you. You've always been out in the public doing what you do and trying to be present and not trying to hide as former police commissioners have done.
Thank you, sir.
Well, I do have one particular question in which I'd like to ask the commissioner.
Yes, sir.
First off, Mark.
Yes, sir.
You said it was Sam Cooke sang that song. I think that was Benny King, wasn't it?
It was not before, but this was Sam Cooke's version.
Oh, okay.
Touché.
Look, it's always good to call in into your show, and it's always good that you've got informative and guests like that. But Commissioner Batt.
Yes, sir.
Mark just asked you a question about two officers that was involved in the incident in which my nephew was killed. You said that you were told that they were not involved. But public records indicate that the same two officers were involved in Anthony Anderson's death, Nicholas Davis Chapman, and Jorge Ruiz, as well as being implicated in a beating, very serious beating incident of Abdul Salam just 2 weeks before my nephew was killed. And these same two officers were involved in three separate serious incidents. How is it that, you know, you were told but you did not investigate to find out personally?
What I did do is have my command staff go back and validate or invalidate the statements that you have made prior to that. And our records do not indicate that. I like to see your public records that in fact show that. So I like to follow up on that. But the critical piece as part of the investigation is going down, excuse me, and part of the investigation is locking all the facts down. One of the reasons when Mark asked me initially in my office about that is that you have not the officers that had contact with Anthony Anderson, but responding officers. When you have an incident like that, you have a lot of officers after the fact that show up to a scene, and they're caught into the log of people that were there, but they weren't there at the confrontational time. What I had to go back and find out is, did any of those officers, either of those officers on Anthony Anderson, respond to that location? And our records through my command staff says that's not correct, and we will follow through. And part of when we come out with the conclusion of the investigation, we will make sure that we have all those facts and we present them to the community as a whole.
When do you think that will take place? The conclusion of this investigation internally.
We have already started the process. As a matter of fact, I think the first meeting of the group is in the next week or so. So as we go through that process, what it will depend on is how much data and information they will continuously need. They may come together and say, we need more of this, more of this, more of this, much like a jury on a trial. And so it depends on how long they take to digest the information and get out a report.
You have a sense that 3 months, 6 months, a year you're talking about?
I don't think it's going to be 6 months. I think with Anthony Anderson, if I remember correctly, it probably took about 2 to 3 months. And I like them to take whatever time they need to look at every piece of evidence. I don't want them to rush, and I want them, when we stand in front of the news cameras, to have the data and have done it correctly and take the time to do it correctly.
Before we go to our next caller, Ivan, George, thanks. Let's see, you have the comment.
Another question, Mark.
Yes.
It is public record that Nicholas David Chapman and Jorge Ruiz were in court because they were taken to court by Nicholas David Chapman by Abdul Salam for that serious beating. So does not your records indicate that, Commissioner Batch?
Who are the officers you're talking about? Just that again. Say that again, George.
Nicholas David Chapman and Jorge Ruiz. The officer that was imported from Florida because he cannot be employed as a police officer in Florida anymore. He's working now for Baltimore City.
And they were brought to court because of...
Yes, sir. 2 weeks prior to Tyrone West beating, they were in court. They were being charged with assault and battery by Abdul Salam for a beating that occurred
right.
2 weeks before my nephew was beaten by the same two officers.
Those two officers were not on the Anthony Anderson case, and I think you may be.
But they were involved in Tyrone West case and in this Abdul Salam case.
Well, what the question was initially was, were they involved in an Anthony Anderson case and a Tyrone West case? And those two officers were not involved in an Anthony Anderson case.
And what George is saying, but they were involved in another case involved.
Those cases that Uncle George just put out are something that we have to research. And if officers have done wrong in the prior cases, they will be held accountable, and they will be disciplined at the same time if they – what they did was appropriate, we will also bring that out too. But we will be a just organization, and we will handle misconduct in an aggressive way. But we will also say when officers do what they are trained to do, we'll address that. If the training is inappropriate, we will reform that. Part of what I'm trying to do within this organization is reform. And I'm not going to make excuses for misconduct. I'm going to be upfront on it. I'm going to address it very strongly. But also I'm going to be very fair to officers, and when they do things right, I'm going to say that too.
So let me ask this question then. Ivan, you're the next caller up. We're going to play this clip from can we play the clip from Donya next? We'll do that next. But first let me ask this question on the way to that phone call into Ivan, our next caller up at 410-319-8888. There's always a question of – this is a complex one I'm about to ask. But the question of what is appropriate force? And people are like, argue, what does that mean? You know, with the whole argument, Anthony Anderson slamming to the ground, ribs puncturing the spleen. Spleen was already damaged, but it would have been punctured if he hadn't been slammed with that ferocity. Some people would argue what happened to Tyrone West, officers surrounding him on the ground. Nobody really knows what happened at that moment, but we know there were a lot of officers surrounding him, and there were bruises on his body from being hit. And so the question is two things. I mean, A, why is force always necessary? It appears when these things happen. And B, you know, in Chicago they have the Chicago Alternative Police Strategy, the CAPS program, where they have taken certain neighborhoods where police are actually on the beat. Where those incidences, from what I've been reading in Chicago papers, have lessened because the police are in the same police officers every day are on the same streets. Talking to the same people, and their relationship with the community has changed. And you know, Chicago was huge gang-related murders, and that has changed. But some people say partially because of the CAPS program or David Kennedy's ideas in other cities that have lowered that kind of violent crime because of the nature of the relationship between police and the citizens. And people put that at the root of a lot of our problems here in Baltimore. That officers do not have an intimate enough relationship with people in our community, especially people who are the ones who suffer the most crime, are victims of the most crime, and where most of the crime occurs.
You threw a lot at me right there.
I said it was complex.
A lot of it I agree with. And you mentioned a number of people who are very good friends of mine who have the same concepts that I have, and we're trying to do the same things in very tough urban cities. Gary McCarthy. Who's a good friend, who's the superintendent of police or commissioner or chief of police equivalent in Chicago. He's a very, very good friend of mine. Known Gary for a decade or plus, and I was just up there visiting him last week. And one of the things that I was sitting down with him and I said, I remember Gary year before last was talking to me and saying, you know, my murder rate's upside down. I'm trying to get things in place. People are not giving me time. I'm pulling out my hair. And as he went into his second year, which was last year, he brought the numbers down because he was able to get the right people in the right position and get his programs there, get his vision online. So I went to him and I said, Gary, I'm trying to get my people in position. Crime rate's up. Things are off balance. And he says, Tony, just stay with what you know, which is what I had, which is what he did. Another program I was looking at up there that he brought online, which we're going to bring here too, is there's a criminology theory out there that talks about legitimacy. And what legitimacy is when a community says this police department polices in a way that I want them to, and the crime rate drops to, then you're a legitimate organization. When you can tout that we dropped the homicide rate dramatically, but you have a community that's up in arms in how you do it, they think that the force is excessive, how you treat them is not legitimate, then you have an illegitimate organization. And so both, whether you're in these major cities, Chicago, what Chuck Ramsey's dealing with, Philadelphia, now Tony Batts is dealing with Baltimore, and that's what the strategic plan is based on, is going to the community and saying, how are we doing as a job as we drop crime within the city? And clearly what the community has said is that we don't like the style of policing in which you do currently. So my job at this point is to retool how we're doing the job, and I've already started that at the same time, keeping not only the homicide rate down and driving it down dramatically, but also the other crimes that go along with that, that normal people are impacted with on a regular basis. So as we build a new police department, as we redo how we do policing as a little bit, and we're going through this shutter, is that we have to connect with those communities and build relationships, period, bottom line. And that's what I am pushing. That's the same thing that Gary McCarthy is doing in Chicago, is that police officers have to understand that, number one, the community pays our salary. Number two, we serve the community. Number three, if we're going to be really good crime fighters, the community has to have trust in us to say, this is the guy who's doing it over there that's hurting us. And your earlier question about use of force, force has to be reasonable depending on the circumstances. What I say, and I've said this for many years, is anytime force is used, there is no time that force looks good, none. When an officer has a legitimate right and it does it correctly, it doesn't look good. Anytime you hit a person with a wooden stick, call a baton, it doesn't look good. If you hit them with a flashlight, it doesn't look good. If you have to strike a human being, it just doesn't look good at any given point in time. It just doesn't. What we have to look at is a force appropriate for the circumstances? If you stop a guy who's engaged in a crime and you tell them to stop and they run and you chase after them and you tackle them, is that an excessive force? I would say no. Your question goes back to, are you trained that way, and is your training commensurate with the act? If you pick a person up and you slam them to the ground, or you kick them, or you do things, or you punch them, things that are unnecessary, that force is excessive to me, unless there's an abnormal circumstance that goes along with that.
Let me be fair and open the phones here again at 410-319-8888. But first, let's go to Donya's comment, if we could, and then we'll go right to our next two callers in a row.
I feel like we too often villainize people, exactly, and dehumanize,
exactly,
them. You know, you have this guy next door to you, and you're, like, ready to just throw all these accusations at him. I bet you have a million things floating in your mind about who he is and what his life is like. I feel like I was reading an article about Commissioner Batts, you know, with the whole comment that he made. And I'm like, you can't take away the value of somebody's life, even if they were drug dealers or even if they were murderers or robbers. Does that mean that their lives aren't just as valuable as somebody else's?
So, and this is, let me just say, Donya Johnson is a student as part of the Intersection program. She's a senior, very bright young woman who grew up in the poorest neighborhoods in our community, was in foster care. The man who took care of her cousin, was murdered by in a gang-related killing because he was in a gang. She related that story to us as well. Her father was incarcerated for most of her life. Her mother was a drug addict. There's a young woman who has kind of taken her life and grabbed hold of it, and she's an incredible young woman. And she was talking, obviously, about the quote that got you into so much trouble in the paper after we talked about who gets killed in this town.
That wasn't a quote that got me in trouble. That was a story. It wasn't a quote, first of all.
Okay.
That was a paraphrase by a young reporter who was upset with me, who was more geared towards trying to embarrass me than really get the story that was out there.
All right.
And, you know, one of the reasons I like coming on your show is that people get to hear it from my mouth and not read it from whether someone has an agenda as a newspaper reporter or not, which was the case there. And the person tweeted out the exact same, that they didn't get a chance to interview me on a particular subject, so they went after me this way, which is very troubling for me. And the reason I have to come on radio and TV more often is that there's very significant messages that I'm trying to get out to the community. There's very important subjects that we need to talk about honestly, authentically, and we're not going to solve them as long as we're playing silly games like that. But I wanted to take that opportunity of that story coming out and kind of, number one, clarify what I was saying, and number two, try to get to a deeper-rooted issue that's there. Now, the young lady that you were talking about, the thing that hits me is I have all those people in my family. I have cousins that have struggled. I have cousins that I love to death that have been to prison. I have cousins that have gone to prison for like at least 20 years for the things that they've done. People that I care about, drug abuse within my family. So that's the circumstance in which I do what I do, because I want to make a difference. I want to help change. And so young people don't have to walk those walks in the future. And that's how significant it is to me. What I was sharing very clearly, and it was taken and turned the other way. What I was sharing, I have a report here. Like you were saying, all these stats are in front of me. There's a report that breaks down every homicide. And it tells you the information on the victims. And it tells you the information on the suspects who were there. And what I was reading off, or what I read off, is in mid-December, is a little bit of facts off of this document. And what it told, the document that I was reading from, shares with the murders. It shares the places of occurrence where the murders take place, if they're in alleys, businesses, churches, the indications of the method or the motive operandi, what we call the motivation for the shootings. Where the person was shot, whether they're shot in the head, whether they're shot in the torso. So we go through all these different things. And on the back page, it talks about the background of the victims. It talks about the background of suspects. And what I read off is, of our victims who were victims of homicide, it said 86.4% of them have prior records. And on the last, and this changes weekly because the number changes, the people, the victims. And it said on the document I had, pretty close to 80%. The people who were the victims in shootings were had drug arrest records. And of the suspects, the same thing, about the same numbers. Most of them had prior records, and most of them had 80% had drug records. And there's a tangential connection to gangs out there, because I told you there's not too many independent drug dealers are out there. You have to be part of an organized gang to be out there. So what I was saying, which was turned the opposite direction, if we have a large number of African-American males who have prior records, who are arrested for being either doing drug dealing or drug buying drugs for some reason, then that should be a message to parents, number one. If your sons fall into this category, there's not a possibility that they may be injured or killed or harmed, but it's a probability that that will occur. If that's the fact, how do we stop young African-American males from getting into gangs, from dealing in drugs? And that goes back to your earlier comment, is as we start addressing these problems, don't we have to start addressing the lack of hope, the issues of poverty, and how do we keep kids from going down that supply chain till they get to the point where we have to put them into the system and lock them up?
I have another question to follow up with that, but let me go to the phones first at 410-319-8888. So we lost Ivan. Sorry, Ivan. You did wait around a bit, but Ernest, you're on the air.
Yeah, good morning to you and your guests.
Good morning, Ernest.
I wanted to address what Commissioner Batt said first about him attending school in an affluent area where most of the children were white. And it's all probability that they were not stopped by police officers. They were not arrested by police officers. So if you're not arrested and you're able to go to college, then you don't have that stigma. You can get loans and your grants and all that. But in black neighborhoods, on 695, where the state police was patrolling, 90% of the people that were stopped on 695 were African Americans. And it didn't matter what age you were. Matter of fact, a Harvard-trained lawyer was stopped with his wife and mother and father in the car. They put them out on the road. That's where they had that big suitcase against the state police. And they still won't give up the records. But I think that in order to have trust in the community, I think the police department should have the Abner Louima approach to investigating excessive force. They shouldn't have the state's attorney who works along with the police. You either have to have the federal government to come in, to have a dual investigation where people know that they cannot lie, they're going to tell the truth, and although their rights are going to be respected, that they're not going to get away with something like that. This is going on all not just in Baltimore City, all over the United States. If you read the paper, it's all kinds of stuff happening, and people are losing faith in the police department. I mean, we know that.
Let me just finish up. But we have a lot of callers, so I want you to get, if you could, just get the point to have the commission respond to. What do you want them to respond to? Ernest?
We know that. Hello?
Go ahead. I just said we have a lot of calls, so I want you to finish up.
We know that if you catch a police selling drugs, using drugs, in vice, or something like that, we know that they're going to be arrested or committing a crime. But excessive force, mainly when an African American is killed, then there seems to be no justice. I mean, Bernstein didn't even take the case to the grand jury, which I thought was very horrible. We done had 14-year-old Samantha Thomas shot in the back, left in the woods to die, and it was justified, and the police was allowed to retire, getting out of a stolen car.
Let me let the commissioner respond. I'm sorry, we only have like six minutes left in the segment. We have other callers. I want.
Well, I can't respond to those cases because I wasn't here and I don't know the background on the ones that he addressed. I am familiar with when he was talking about, I believe it's New Jersey State Police, as people were driving up the 95. Actually, I had a good friend who was a chief of police of New Orleans at that time, Richard Pennington, and he shared with me when he was stopped his anger and frustration. So I know about the background there. What I'm bringing is reform to this organization. Everything that I'm doing, everything that I'm saying, everything that I'm putting in place is to make sure that we have a professional police department that is done, that does its job constitutionally as we continue to drop crime within the city in all categories. I have an 80-point plan that I am putting in place within this organization, and we're retooling from training to tracking to holding people accountable for force. And so what we're also doing is giving the proper tools to the police officers to enable them to get the job done. But we will hold people accountable when they use force that's excessive. Part of bringing professional panels in from outside is trying to build the trust within the community that we're doing it correctly, that we're doing it right, and that we're going to be open and accessible about it. One of the things that I've always said, and I've said this to my police officers, is that I've hired thousands and thousands of police officers as being the chief of police or commissioner in three different cities. I've put medals around the necks of very brave and courageous police officers and shook their hands and thanked them for their courage. But I've also put handcuffs on police officers and sent them to prison. And so I have no qualms about celebrating good officers, but I have no tolerance for officers that are bad, and we will hold them accountable if that's the case.
410-319-8888. We'll come back to the phones in just a minute. I wanted to... I think a lot about what you were just saying. One of the things that's going on in Wisconsin right now that we're going to be exploring here is they put in a police accountability bill in the state legislature, which says what Ernest was alluding to. And Ernest, who called in, I know he's called him before, he's a retired police officer. But the police accountability bill is something that says when there are police-involved homicides, that investigation should be done by an independent union. Not inside the state's attorneys, not inside anywhere else. They can include the state's attorney or the police, but an independent investigation from the outside. So there is clarity and there is transparency and take the politics out of it.
Sounds like what we've done on Anthony Anderson and Tyrone West.
Do you think that should be a law?
I don't think it. Me personally, I don't think it should be a law. What you're seeing is exactly that being done. No one is making me do this. I'm not making everyone happy within the organization by doing it. I can tell you that the president of the FOP and I have had very, very strong conversations about this. But I think it's the right thing to do for all the right reasons. And I don't have government mandate to make it happen. I'm doing it because I'm trying to build the public trust. And number two, I don't think we have anything to hide. If officers are doing the job correctly, then we'll say they're doing it correctly. If they're not, then we'll call the balls and strikes as they come, and we'll correct and we will reform this organization.
Do you think the police officers, very quickly, about 3 minutes left here? Oh, let's go to a caller. I'll let them have the last say today. We have 3 minutes left. Verna in Baltimore, you're on the air.
Yes, good morning, Mr. Steiner. Hope you're well. Listen,
thank you.
I want to address this. Who is this guy to address him properly? Who is his title? Mr. Steiner, who is this man signed the title of your guest?
The title? Commissioner Anthony Batts.
Is it for police commissioner or what?
Commissioner Anthony Batts.
Okay. I would like to say to Commissioner Anthony, and piggyback on the caller, the aim of the police department in the United States of America is not to serve and protect the black family, okay? Their aim is to really kill, emasculate, and destroy the black male. Like that man said, I live in New York, Chicago, and Baltimore. The police brutality is the same. In my own experience, some guy stole my car. It was an old car. 14 and 17. I asked for the 14-year-old to please have community service since this charges, since he was so low. The evil white policewoman, just like they do in the suburbs. And I know that because my son worked with the juvenile department in Chicago. They give them community service. When I asked for community service, do you know what the white police woman told me? Well, you're not in the suburbs, you're in the city. The whole attitude is you are of destruction.
I'm sorry, we're literally out of time. We have a minute left. Anthony, do you want to have a quick response?
I'm sorry to hear that she has those concerns, but you know what I say to people is that, number one, I'm an African-American male. I grew up in very tough streets. What I proudly say, I grew up in a ghetto. That's where I grew up, in South Central, and I'm proud of that fact. And I share that fact because people need to know that I can and I do see both sides. They also have to understand that my two sons are African-American males also, and they're nowhere in their forehead that does it say son of chief of police or son of a commissioner. So as we build this organization, I'm building an organization from my standpoint that is fair to everybody in every sector of the city, and building an organization that hopefully in the future we won't have these type of calls where they're saying this organization is a professional organization that protects the rights of everyone in a very constitutional way.
Commissioner Anthony Batts, thank you so much for joining us once again. Look forward to seeing you again about next month or whenever you have the time available. Good to have you here.
Anytime you want me.
We're going to take a brief break and come back and look at Lawyers at Bail. We're going to go out with some more Sam Cooke, Twisting the Night Away. So if you're stuck at home, twist on as we go to break. We'll be right back.
Somewhere up in New York way, where the people are so gay, twisting the